Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today, as every day, from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, many people have drawn historical comparisons between the early 2000s and the decade of the 1930s. And the parallels are fairly clear. I mean, we're coming out of a terrible economic crisis. We have a new, relatively liberal president replacing an older, relatively conservative president. There are fears not just of economic collapse, but, you know, the societal implications of that. What's going to happen to our society? So whether you believe there's a lot of parallel or a little parallel between the two, I think it'll be interesting today to talk about the 1930s and to talk especially to a woman named Sally Denton, who's written a fascinating book about that era called The Plots Against the President. Now, the president in that case was FDR, but she'll draw the same sorts of parallels I've been talking about with our current decade. I also thought it would be interesting to put the decade of the 1930s into a little bit of context and talk about some of the more prominent political and media personalities of that decade. So I've asked one of my former students, a fellow by the name of Drew Taylor. Hello, Drew.
Hey, Professor, how are you doing?
Doing well, to come into the studio and tell us about three fascinating personalities. Now, we'll get to those actual discussions a little bit later, but just to let people know, who are the three fellows we're going to be talking about today?
Well, sure, Professor. The first we're going to talk about is the radio priest, Father Coughlin.
The radio priest?
Yes, sir. He pushes about as far right as you can get.
Okay.
Secondly, we're going to be talking about Governor of Louisiana, former Governor of Louisiana, Huey Long.
Huey Long.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
He pushes about as far left as you can get.
Ah.
And somebody that folks have probably heard of, Charles Lindbergh.
Now he pushes up in the air,
that
right?
That is exactly right. And we're going to see how you can push so far left, you start coming back from the right side.
Okay. Well, with that, a wonderful introduction by Drew Taylor. Why don't we go ahead and speak to author Sally Denton? Now, Sally Denton has written a number of interesting books. She, in fact, has written books as things about the Pink Lady, very famous politician from California, Helen Gahagan Douglas. She's written other books called Passion and Principle, Faith and Betrayal. There's no one theme to her books. In fact, as she'll explain later, she simply goes where her research takes her. Now, I understand you have written a book with a very, very provocative title called Plots Against the President.
Yes, it's The Plots Against the President, and I think a lot of people assume that it might be against Obama.
Which president?
The president. It's Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And it's really about the year 1933. It's a very contained period between November 1932, when Roosevelt was elected president, when he defeated Herbert Hoover, and the end of 1933, the first year in office. And I was really fortunate in finding an element of the Roosevelt presidency that had never really been explored by others. And I think part of that reason is that he went on to, you know, such a great, long, and active life and presidency that this one year was kind of forgotten.
Well, now, when you say plots against the president, are you talking about run-of-the-mill political cabals and people who oppose them, or are you talking about something more?
Well, there were a lot of those.
Uh-huh.
But the two, I basically frame the book around two different events. One was the assassination attempt of Roosevelt in February 1933.
Right.
And this was in the interregnum period between when he had been elected and when he took office, because in those days, the inauguration was not until March, the first week of March. And so there was that attempted assassination. And then the second event was an actual business, what was called the business plot or a Wall Street putsch, where a group of wealthy bankers and brokers and industrialists actually considered a fascist takeover of the government.
Whoa, this is sounding very interesting. In fact, I'm going to take a wild guess and say that most people listening to this have never heard of either of those events.
Well, I had not heard of either one, and actually I was researching my most recent book, The Pink Lady, which was about Helen Gahagan Douglas, who had run against Richard Nixon for the U.S. Senate.
There's a fascinating topic. She was a remarkable woman.
She was a remarkable woman, and it was a remarkable story. It was really considered one of the most vicious modern smear campaigns of American history.
Well, maybe we'll have to talk about that one sometime. We may very well have to, because that's another often overlooked figure in our 20th century political history.
And that book just came out this week in paperback, The Pink Lady. And so I was researching her. I was researching the right wing. Richard Nixon identified her, called her a communist, which is, he called her the Pink Lady. And in fact, she then responded.
Oh, so that was that was not a compliment.
No.
It
was implying that he was trying to make the voters of California believe that she was a communist because she was a liberal.
Ah.
And she's the one who gave him the moniker Tricky Dick. But while researching that book at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, I came across this file about the assassination attempt by a tiny Italian immigrant named Giuseppe Zangara. And I had never heard of this assassination attempt. And at the same time, looking through the archives at the Hoover Institution, I found references to the American Liberty League and the John Birch Society and these various conservative organizations that really were springing up. And that's where as I was finishing The Pink Lady, I became very interested in these plots against FDR and the New Deal, the attempts to really kill the New Deal.
Right. That's one of the great pleasures of doing research about one topic, is that it so often leads to other topics.
Absolutely. I love that.
Yeah,
and
I do too.
Actually, this is my seventh book, and each one of mine, it's funny because I'm asked to speak at various places around the country about various books, and people are always surprised about, you know, the previous books. But every single one of them, I've come to figure out that, I mean, I've written about drug trafficking in Kentucky and organized crime in Las Vegas, Nevada. I've written about a Mormon massacre in Utah. I've written about, I've written about John C. Fremont and Jesse Fremont, and who was the first, John Fremont was the first Republican candidate for president, and they seem to be disparate themes and not connected, but really each one has led to the next one. As I finish one, and I'm always starting, because I write for a living, I'm always starting to panic about what my next subject will be, and inevitably at the end of one, another idea that naturally flows from it crops up.
And we're very happy that eventually it brought you to FDR and the plots against him. So let's get to it. What tell us about these plots?
Well, it was a moment not unlike America today, where it seemed like capitalism was broken. Men couldn't feed their families. The rich were getting richer. There were tax loopholes for the rich, farmers were losing their farms, and the conditions were horrendous. I mean, it was about, I think, a $16 weekly wage was the average, if anybody even had a job.
Mm-hmm.
There were 34 million without income, and a thousand homes a day were being foreclosed, and millions unemployed. I think 16 million unemployed at the height of the Depression in 1933. And there was this whole sense that that the system was broken, and the biggest issue was what level government intervention should take in private industry, and especially in banking. Wall Street and banking was really seen as the culprit here. And so the plot against the coup attempt was, well, let's start first with the assassination attempt. That was in Miami, and this was the suspect was an anarchist who was railing against all capitalists and really saw Roosevelt as the uber capitalist. And he was an anti-fascist, anti-Mussolini Italian immigrant. And
his name was Zangara, right?
Zangara, and he was this was before Roosevelt had even taken office, and nobody really knew what his policies were going to be. He was, you know, he had been governor of New York, but there was not a sense that, and in fact, I'm not sure that Roosevelt even knew what his policies were going to be yet. But there was a sense that he, because he was a patrician, because he was from an aristocratic family, there was a sense that he wasn't going to be radically different from Hoover or, you know, some of the previous presidents.
It's a reasonable supposition given his background, because he was about as aristocratic as an American can be.
Right, he was. I mean, if there was American royalty, Roosevelt was part of that class, which is one of the reasons that what he ended up doing seemed so surprising to his class.
Right, but at this point, Zangara's thinking just more of the same. This is just another Wall Street guy, another one of these aristocratic guys. So I better, take him out?
Right. And he was, you know, at the time, the United States was on very friendly terms with Mussolini, and the Hoover administration certainly had been, and Zangara assumed that the Roosevelt administration would be too, and he even said that he just, you know, he fired these shots at Roosevelt in Miami because Roosevelt had been cruising with five of the wealthiest men in America, cruising the Caribbean, waiting to be inaugurated, and they came into Miami, and the Miami mayor and some of the dignitaries in Florida had thrown together a kind of a meet and greet, or just kind of a bandstanding kind of event for Roosevelt to be greeted by citizens of Miami. And Zangara happened to read about it in the newspaper. He was planning to go up to Washington and assassinate Herbert Hoover, but it was cold up there, and when he heard that Roosevelt was coming into Miami, he thought, well, this is easier. I'll just stay here and kill him instead. He had tried to kill Herbert Hoover before in California, and he claimed that he had been involved in an assassination attempt on the King of Italy. But so he was, you know, he was a radical anti-capitalist, and so there was that plot, and then the second plot that I deal with is the coup attempt after Roosevelt became.
Well, no, wait, before we get there, now I want to know. Let's just finish the story. What exactly happened? I mean, did he actually start shooting the place up?
Oh yeah, he came in. There were Roosevelt was accompanied by his entourage that had been on the Norma Hall, which was this gleaming ocean liner, private ocean liner, owned by the Astors, and they came into the park in the evening in Miami, this entourage with three open vehicles, and Roosevelt came and was lifted. I mean, you remember, he's paralyzed, so that presented a lot of challenges to the Secret Service at the time. He was lifted onto the back of his car. He spoke for very briefly, really just for 2 or 3 minutes, and it was not to be a speech. It was just to kind of wave, and he spoke for a couple of minutes, and shots rang out. Zangara had gotten on top of a chair. This was a grandstand where it was like a bank of chairs that were all connected to each other, and a lot of the people that had come to see the president-elect were standing on their chairs. Zangara came and jumped onto a chair with another woman and lifted his arm over her shoulder and pointed down at Roosevelt and started firing.
How far away was he?
He was very close. I think 20 to 30 feet. It was very close.
20 to 30
feet,
wow.
But she started, the chair shook when he jumped on it, and she claims that she knocked him down. Others claim that other people knocked him down when the firing started.
When the first shot was fired, I realized he was shooting at the president. So my first thought was to get the pistol up in the air so he wouldn't hurt any of the bystanders.
But anyway, five people were hit, and one died, the mayor of Chicago, Anton Cermak, who was had come down to see Roosevelt and was walking toward him with his hand extended to shake his hand when the shots rang out. And so he was one of the ones that was hit.
I don't think he died instantly, did he?
He didn't die instantly, and in fact, one of the reasons that Roosevelt became so lauded in the, I mean, he was, at this point, Roosevelt was considered kind of an effete playboy, dilettante, you know, cruising the Caribbean. But when Cermak was hit, he insisted, rather than have his driver get the president-elect out of the way, which is, of course, what the security wanted to do, he insisted that they get Cermak loaded into the car with him, and he actually held him and talked with him all the way to the hospital, which is what doctors credited with saving Cermak's life, because he would have gone into shock had Roosevelt not insisted, you know, that he stay conscious and alert. So he didn't die for a couple of weeks, and actually he probably didn't need to die. They didn't remove the bullet, and as it turns out, they should have. But
Roosevelt did save his life and at least give the doctors the opportunity to save him, and unfortunately that didn't happen.
Right, he saved his life, and then from that point forward, and then there was this apocryphal remark that Cermak supposedly made to Roosevelt, "I'm glad it was me instead of you," which is inscribed on sculptures and things. But
and we don't know if he actually said that.
It's been disputed, so mm-hmm. I don't know. But he was a powerful political figure in Chicago. And at the time, well, first, Roosevelt was really seen as this great hero all of a sudden, you know, this man who was paralyzed from the waist down, actually saving the life, you know, for the man who apparently took a bullet for him. And so there was this kind of wildly exciting response suddenly to Roosevelt just before he takes office, in which he's seen now as this larger-than-life figure who not only survived the debilitating disease of polio, but actually saved somebody's life. And that was really the turning point when Americans rushed in to embrace him.
Well, before we leave and get into the politics of it, now, you said five people were hit. Who were the other four?
Well, the other four were just bystanders,
mm-hmm.
and different, you know, people who had come to see Roosevelt. So they were not dignitaries, but just people in the crowd. And
did they all survive?
They all survived.
Okay,
a couple were, you know, in critical condition for a while. But part of the reason that this kind of disappeared into what I call hidden history is that Roosevelt himself, along with and his advisors and along with many of the investigators, really tried to downplay that he was the target, and they generated this story that Cermak was the intended target of the assassination because he was a Chicago politician and he was taking on Al Capone at the time, and that, you know, they floated the story that this was a mob hit. And I think that was initially done because America was at such a precarious moment, and it was determined by all of them, including the president-elect, that this was not a moment to further unhinge America with fears of assassination.
Well, that is remarkable, and if I may say so, if that's in fact what happened, then it sounds very statesmanlike on Roosevelt's part, because of course the temptation would be to accept all the accolades and to portray oneself as this heroic figure and use that politically going into office, because of course there were lots of things to be done. But if he really and truly said, I'm not going to do that, in fact I'm going to dissemble a little bit here, which Roosevelt also did from time to time.
Yeah.
You know, because he simply didn't want people to have any greater sense of political instability than already existed. That's arguably pretty statesmanlike.
It was very remarkable, and the people around him at the time said that his calm was, I think Raymond Mulvey said he had never seen such magnificent calm. You know, that here is a man who narrowly escaped being killed or being fired, you know, being shot, and that he maintained calm. He refused to allow it. He could have kind of assumed dictatorial powers, which is what a lot of people were recommending that he do. But instead, you know, when he got to New York, on his way to the inaugural New York from Florida, and he was greeted by a phalanx of security, he didn't want that, and he never wanted that. He wanted to be in the crowd, not to seem to be, you know, not of them. And in the inaugural, he dismissed, he didn't want a covered vehicle. And so, yeah, he could have used it in a very different way. And I think it was very statesmanlike, and I think it really gave him a unique power that he was able to use immediately with as he gets into his first 100 days.
Yeah, in fact, one can argue a little more cynically, perhaps, that he didn't need to accept the accolades because, of course, the value to him had already occurred. And I have to say, I'm reminded of somebody from the other end of the political spectrum about 50 years later. Was Ronald Reagan, I think, in 81, it was the assassination attempt against him right after he'd been inaugurated. And he also behaved with great grace under pressure and was even sort of joking with people. I think he
with
told
the doctors.
He told the doctors. What did he say? I sure hope you all.
He hoped that they were Republicans.
Right, I sure hope you're all Republicans. You know, and whether you agree with Reagan or whether you agree with Roosevelt, whatever part of the spectrum you're on, you have to admire that kind of grace under pressure.
That kind of grace, and it's really, you know, it's a moment when a lesser man might use it to, you know, rouse the public. And Reagan did the same thing. I mean, he focused on, this is a lone wolf person, you know, obsessed with, was it the guy obsessed with Jodie Foster?
Right.
And instead, you know, he could have used it for political purposes, that, you know, these are disaffected people that are reaching, you know.
Well, maybe I sound like a cynic, but I think both presidents were astute enough to realize that they didn't have to do anything. They were going to get value. They were going to get goodwill from these things. And it's interesting that both of them, most notably Roosevelt, but both of them had very active and successful first parts of their first terms. And to some extent, they both may have benefited from these assassination attempts.
Yeah, I bet you're right. I mean, I haven't really thought about that. But it certainly elevated Roosevelt in the minds of the public. These were on newsreels throughout America, and all of a sudden this man was really seen as larger than life.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're talking about the 1930s, and specifically we're talking with Sally Denton, who's written a very provocative book called The Plots Against the President. Stay tuned.
I was called in by the state's attorney and the sheriff to examine this man who tried to assassinate President Roosevelt right after the crime, and I found him to be sane in every respect.
I like him. He was an older president, and I'm going to kill him as a president. He's a president.
Would you shoot me?
You're not president.
You won't shoot me?
What should shoot you? You're a working man.
We let you go. Would you kill him now?
Yeah, you let me go.
Well, okay. Anything else about the Zangara assassination attempt, then?
Well, it was one of the swiftest executions in American history.
Oh, really?
He was executed within, I think, 2 weeks of Cermak's death. He was tried initially. He was tried within a week for the first shootings.
In Florida?
This was in Miami. He pled guilty he admitted doing it, said that he did it because capitalism was ruining the world. And he was, as soon as Cermak died, he was given the death sentence and electrocuted in what Florida called Old Sparky, which was where the old electric chair.
Which was...
Within weeks. And while in jail waiting for this, he wrote a memoir talking about, you know, the corruption of the capitalists, the corruption of the fascists, And he was tied later to an element of anti-fascist throughout the United States. And that was another thing that I think it was important for the government that, you know, at a moment when America's tottering, it was important to downplay the radicalism and the revolutionary impulses that were going on at the moment.
And there were a lot of them. I mean, and in fact, we have to remember that in the early 1930s, you were seeing the rise of fascism, most notably in Nazi Germany. And it was not beyond the pale to think that something like that could happen here. In fact, there was a book of that title that was written just a few years later called It Can't Happen Here.
It can't happen, yeah, Sinclair Lewis.
Sinclair Lewis, right.
The nation's most powerful publisher, William Randolph Hearst, believed that America needed a dictator. And
whether from the left or from the right, I mean, the communists and the Nazis battled it out in Germany, and either one of them could have won. And
right.
So, again, it was not that extreme to think that this could happen. So now I'm understanding better why Roosevelt wanted to play this down.
Well, and also this was a moment when there was a great affection and interest among the intellectual elite and on both sides, as you said, the left and the right. There was a fascination with fascism. Nobody quite yet knew what, I mean, Hitler came to power the same week as Roosevelt,
yeah.
And there were certainly indicators that this was not going to be a pleasant thing.
Not a pleasant thing indeed, fascism, not a pleasant thing. But isn't it remarkable, Drew, that it was, according to Sally Denton, becoming something that was being acceptable? The people, intellectuals, were saying that they thought perhaps fascism was a good thing. How do you account for that? Do any of these people you're going to tell us about have anything to do with that, do you think?
Indeed, Professor. In fact, one of the most notable, fascist-leaning spokespeople we have at this time was Father Coughlin.
Uh-huh.
Now, Father Coughlin was born originally in Canada,
mm-hmm.
To two good Irish parents,
mm-hmm.
and he grew up as a staunch Roman Catholic. However, by a wild turn of fate, he went from being a pastor of a small church to being one of the most prolific and influential radio personalities of the 1930s.
That is remarkable. And he was all over the country. And did he ever actually come out and favor fascism? Did he ever come out and attack the Jews or favor Nazism?
Well, it depends on who you ask. On the one hand, it can be said that he was very careful to say that he was not an anti-Semite. Being a Christian leader, he said that, you know, you have to have understanding towards all these different peoples and Gentiles and Jew alike. However, he did specify that he had issue with what you would call the bad Jews.
The bad Jews,
uh-huh. The money changers.
Uh-huh.
In fact, he went from being a small town Catholic priest to someone of whom it was said he was a priest more famous at the microphone than at Mass, one who could woo more men to a convention hall than to a communion rail, and he spent more time in politics than in parish halls.
Good heavens.
Yes, sir. So at the very height of Mr. Coughlin's radio career, he had over four political secretaries. He had over 100 clerks to answer some of the 80,000 letters he got in the course of a week.
Good night.
So it can be said that his influence was widespread and quite significant.
Uh-huh.
Now, when you listen to Father Coughlin, it's not hard to understand why he had such a wonderful impact on people. Well, wonderful in quotes. He had a significant impact
mm-hmm.
on folks. When he speaks, when you hear him speak, he has a very controlled tone, the type you only had in the 1930s. But you could tell underlying this very impactful speech that he was about to boil over with emotion. And you could tell as he spoke, he had a really subtle Irish lilt.
But every intelligent American Christian whose heart bleeds for his 20 million fellow Christians who were butchered by the Trotskys and Belagoons, the Bronsteins and the Coens in Soviet Russia, in the Ukraine, in Hungary and elsewhere, they appeal to the Jews of America to join with them in removing communism, the cause of Nazism.
Well, so the Jews caused Nazism.
That's exactly right, Professor.
No idea.
According to Father Coughlin, the Jews were a significant issue with a lot of what was going on in America at that time. The New Deal, Father Coughlin lovingly referred to as the Jew Deal.
I see, because of course it wasn't Roosevelt, it was Rosenfeld, right?
That's exactly correct. He was so wildly popular, one could even make the comparison that he was the Rush Limbaugh of his time.
The Rush Limbaugh of the 1930s. Well, thank you, Drew Taylor. We'll have you back in a few minutes. You can tell us about some other fascinating figures from the 1930s.
I'll be here.
Well, now let's go back and talk some more with Sally Denton about the plots against the president.
at this point, Mussolini was greatly revered by the intellectual elite in the United States. And, you know, at the same moment that there's this Great Depression in America, there's a global economic collapse going on, and yet Mussolini seems to be the only one in Europe who's holding it together. His country is, you know, the trains are famously running on time, and there was a great sense that America, that capitalism was at the end of its rope, and democracy as we knew it was failed. And there was
Didn't Charles Lindbergh's wife, she was the daughter, I think, of a wealthy diplomat, and didn't she write a book that was called The New Wave or The Next Wave or something like
Wait,
that?
Wait, I don't know, but that sounds fascinating.
I think she did. Charles Lindbergh was often suggested that he was a Nazi sympathizer, although he, of course, always disputed that. And he was very much part of the right wing in the America of the 1930s, trading on his celebrity as the first to cross the Atlantic in the spirit of St. Louis. He married a woman. I'm speaking here just completely from memory, but he married a woman who shared his beliefs to a great extent. And I think they actually made exactly the argument you're talking about now, and they called it the next wave or the new wave, saying that capitalism was done, liberal democracy was done, and that fascism or more state control of industry was the wave of the future.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that book, but I would find that fascinating. And
maybe that's your next book. You can write about Charles Lindbergh. Okay. But anyway, I interrupted you, but I think we're segueing into the right-wing plots now, aren't we?
Yeah, and actually Lindbergh figures into that, not that he was involved in the plot, but there was this kind of cottage industry that was growing up in the summer of 1933 against Roosevelt and trying to, because of his monetary policies, taking America off the gold standard, authorizing new currency, and which was highly controversial. And there was a lot of people were of the, you know, the extreme right were claiming that Roosevelt was Jewish, that this was all part of a Jewish conspiracy.
Oh, the Jews again. They're behind everything,
yeah,
right?
Jews.
Yeah,
and
they must
be. They even at one point, you know, some of these wackadoos were kind of accusing Roosevelt of covering up for the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby, who, you know, remember, which was done by the suspect was a Jewish, I think an itinerant Jewish worker. And so the
Bruno
Lindbergh,
somebody, Bruno, I think it was his
Bruno somebody,
but Hauptmann or something like that.
The Lindbergh kidnapping kind of symbolized this fear of the underclass and the populist movement, which was often seen as, you know, these kind of radical Jews coming in from Russia and destabilizing America and creating, you know, advocating communism. And so there was this attempt to prove that Roosevelt was Jewish. I mean, it was like the birther movement. They were actually, there was actually a movement to try and trace the Roosevelt bloodlines back to the Huguenot Dutch ancestry.
The Nazis were really into that, too. In fact, I think Hitler referred to Roosevelt as Rosenfeld. Something
and,
of that sort.
Yeah,
of
it was all this kind of eugenics, and I think Lindbergh was allegedly into that as well.
Oh, my goodness.
But, yeah. So anyway, that's a little digression into another Lindbergh.
We do lots of digressions here. That's perfectly okay. So onward, then. What about this Wall Street putsch?
So the Wall Street plot, it was it grew out of the Bonus Army. The Bonus Army was a group of World War I veterans. There were more than 500,000 of them who had been promised bonuses that from their World War I service, and they were not going to originally get their bonuses until later, like a decade later. But they mobilized and marched on Washington asking Congress to release the bonuses to them in 1932 because they were destitute, and the bonuses amounted to about $500 a soldier. Which was a lot of money in the middle of the Depression.
Oh, yeah.
So 45,000 marchers came to Washington and in the summer of 32 while Hoover was still president. And Hoover basically sent the army, General MacArthur, out and routed them out. And there were 100 casualties. And it was a disaster because these were unarmed men, women, and children, their whole families, and they had mobilized from all across the country and marched on Washington.
You've touched upon another giant of the 20th century, and of course that's MacArthur.
MacArthur, who Roosevelt thought the most dangerous man in America.
That was what I was going to say. Good. Yeah, he was very frightened. I mean, MacArthur was willing to, I don't know if they actually fired on the bonus marchers or not, but he was willing.
They did.
They fired on them.
They used sabers. They, you know, chased them down with bayonets. It was horrific. And, of course, all of this was on the newsreels, too, and Americans were horrified to see, you know, the American army basically, you know, coming down on American soldiers. And, I mean, nothing except for the Civil War even could, you know, resemble that in the nation's capital.
That would be like the president now, President Obama, calling out current troops to go and march on Iraq war veterans in the mall.
Well, it would be like Obama calling out troops to go and to all of the Occupy Wall Street locations and just, you know, go in and rout them out.
Yeah. But I think it would be even more poignant for a lot of people if it were, you know, actual veterans, you know, because current soldiers going after former soldiers. And World War I was only about, what, 10, 15 years in the past at this point.
Right. It was very recent.
Yeah.
And these men, you know, there were no pensions for them. No, I mean, this was a moment when there were no safety nets in America. And it was very sad to see this huge population of destitute veterans that couldn't feed their families, couldn't feed themselves. And so that was really what defeated Hoover. But so what happened later then, the following year, this group of plotters from New York basically approached a man named Smedley Butler, who was a retired Marine general, who was really the veterans' iconic leader of the veterans. They loved him. He was a soldier's soldier, and he had written extensively and spoken extensively out against the Wall Street interests that he increasingly saw American military protecting in various theaters. He had been in the Boxer Rebellion in China. He had been in Haiti. He had been in South America, and he started to speak out about his belief that war was really a racket, that the U.S. military, what they were doing, it was less defensive and more imperialistic, and that the U.S. military was basically serving as a enforcement element, a security element, for security force for American corporations. Hmm. And with that, he got a huge following among these soldiers. So because he was seen as the leader of these half a million soldiers, the plotters came to him and basically asked him to lead a nonviolent march on Washington to replace Roosevelt and install another general as in a military dictatorship.
Whoa, now that's remarkable, and I want to talk more about that. But before we get there, there's one thing that might seem incongruous right now, and that is that this anti-war aspect of General Smedley, you said what his name was?
Smedley Butler.
General Butler's anti-war stance sounds left-wing right now, but we have to remember that a large segment of the population, a very conservative segment of the population, was very isolationist.
Right. This was a very isolationist approach, and in fact, it reminds me of Ron Paul. You know, he believed that basically America should have a very strong military, but it should never extend beyond, I think, 100 miles of any of our coasts.
Okay. Well, that makes more sense then. Okay. So this is a right-wing fellow.
Yeah. So it was very offensive.
Okay, but an isolationist right wing. Okay.
Right. And this group that came to him claimed that they had $300 million that they were raising, that they had weapons if they needed them from Remington Arms, and that they were afraid because of the gold standard that they were losing their fortunes because of the Roosevelt, the New Deal monetary policies. And so they had the American Legion, and which American Legion was kind of their muscle and their lobbying power. But and then they had the Liberty League that they created, which was created and comprised as much by disaffected conservative Democrats as by Republicans.
It was, okay, now who were these people who were creating the Liberty League and who were approaching General Butler? Who were these guys?
Well, it was the one who approached him was a guy named Jerry Maguire, who was a bond salesman, and then there was Robert Sterling Clark, who was a Wall Street broker and I think heir to the Singer sewing machine. There was Grayson Murphy, who was a private had a private banking firm, and they claimed to have the DuPonts and
DuPont was then the head of General Motors, wasn't? No, Sloan had come on by then, or anyway, DuPont with the chemical company,
with the petrochemical, yeah, right. The huge chemical giant, and who also owned, I think, controlling interest in Remington Arms.
Mm.
So these were very big, very conservative, very right-wing financial, industrialists and bankers and businessmen. And the mistake was that they went to Butler. They apparently had wanted to go to MacArthur because that's who was more ideologically compatible with them, but they knew that MacArthur would never get the support of the veterans because he had routed them out.
Right.
So they were kind of in this, you know, they were kind of in this dilemma that the only man who could get the support of, who could really lead a 500,000 veterans to do something in Washington was Smedley Butler. But on the other hand, Butler was so appalled and saw it as a treasonous, move that he blew the whistle on it.
I'm Stuart Harris, and we're talking with Sally Denton about her new book, The Plots Against the President. Stick around.
Is the third powerful group which has been carrying this country toward war. Its members have used the war emergency to obtain a third presidential term for the first time in American history. They have used the war to add unlimited billions to a debt which was already the highest we have ever known. And they have used the war to justify the restriction of congressional power and the assumption of dictatorial procedures on the part of the president and his appointees.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. We've been talking to Sally Denton, who's just been telling us about the loyalty of General Smedley Butler. He was approached by some right-wing industrialists who wanted him to become a dictator. He refused. His loyalty was unquestioned. But the fellow you just heard, another military guy, this time it's a colonel, his loyalty was, well, let's just say it was often questioned during the 1930s. Who was this fellow we just heard from, Drew?
We just heard from Charles Lindbergh, Professor.
Charles Lindbergh, the spirit of St. Louis, the lone eagle?
The very same.
Say it ain't so.
It's so.
What happened? What did he do during the 1930s?
Well, we have a man who was catapulted from being a mere mail carrier, air carrier, to being somebody who folks would listen to. Being raised by his parents, his dad was a former politician, his mom was a school teacher, he was raised in an idea of believing in eugenics.
Eugenics?
Yes, Professor.
He was a guy who believed in selective breeding of humanity?
That is exactly right. In fact, he said of his own wife that he wanted a woman with keen intellect, good health, and strong genes.
Not necessarily bad attributes, but not very subtly put. How did Charles Lindbergh fit into the 1930s?
Well, he believed that there was a conflict coming. Mm-hmm. He knew that there was a war currently starting between Stalin on one side and Hitler on the other. And he said that our bond with Europe, quote, our bond with Europe is one about race, not of political ideology.
Wow. And didn't he also seem to think that if not desirable, at least that fascism was inevitable?
That is correct. He said that if he had to pick one, that would be the one he chose.
Wow. And he was also an ardent isolationist, as we just heard in that clip from his speech.
That is exactly correct. He said that when it was coming down to the conflict, he wasn't anti the United States, he wasn't anti Jews, and he wasn't anti the British. However, he felt that there was a definite British and a definite Jewish conglomerate of folks who were actually pushing the United States into war, and he felt that wasn't in the United States' best interest. In fact, he was pushing more towards an alignment with Hitler, so that when Hitler did eventually come to the United States, the American people would be better cared for.
Well, let's just be glad that his predictions didn't play out. Thank you, Drew Taylor, for telling us a little bit about Charles Lindbergh and his strange odyssey after the Spirit of St. Louis. And now let's go back and talk a little bit more with Sally Denton and the rise of a right-wing conspiracy against the president.
It might have happened.
You know, that is so interesting because it might have. And in fact, this reminds me so much of Hitler's ascent to power. Now, Hitler had been around since the early 20s. You know, I think he formed his party in 23 or thereabouts. And he always was sort of marginal until the conditions were right and until he could convince a lot of the German industrialists and bankers to go along with him and fund him.
Mm-hmm. And the same with Mussolini.
Right. And so the same thing was happening here, or at least it looked like it was happening. The conditions were right. There were some very, very wealthy people. Did they actually have all this money and this access to Remington arms that they were claiming to have?
Absolutely. They had the money. And they sent this Jerry Maguire was kind of the middleman. They sent him to Europe to look at these various organizations, these paramilitary fascist organizations that were involved in the rise of Hitler, the rise of Mussolini. They looked at an organization in France, and they all had these. I have a chapter in my book called "A Rainbow of Colored Shirts." They were the black shirts, and he came back and was promoting, you know, this creation of these various organizations: the silver shirts, the black shirts, the brown shirts, the khaki shirts, the white shirts. I mean, by 33, there were just a panoply of these paramilitary organizations.
Sally, I've just come up with a theory. I think that the people who were really behind all of this were the shirt manufacturers.
The shirt manufacturers.
That ties it all together. It must be.
That could be my next song.
Yes, yes. The collar conspiracy, okay? Okay, well, but not to, that's obviously a silly suggestion, but not to make light of this. I mean, this actually looks to me like the beginnings of something that it was actually a credible conspiracy.
Well, yeah, when Butler claimed that a group of powerful businessmen had solicited him to lead this coup d'etat against Roosevelt, you know, the government investigators took him seriously because it was so clear that America was at this tenuous moment. And that, you know, it wasn't just dismissed as crazy because of the climate, as you said. You know, these tensions were simmering here, and I think what really surprised me the most in researching this book, because I'm not a Roosevelt scholar and I'm not a scholar of the era, I was really surprised at really how precarious and tenuous the country was at that moment. And how seriously the business plot, whether or not it really endangered the Roosevelt presidency, is debatable, which was why it was so hard to find information about it. I mean, most of this stuff in my book are footnotes in the dozens, if not hundreds, of biographies and books about the Roosevelt presidency and the New Deal era. But I've often found that the best stories are in the footnotes.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, and I'm going to sound like a real nerd, but I actually enjoy reading the footnotes almost as much as the body of some books that I read. And you're right, lots of the good stuff is buried there. But to get back to this, now, what happened? I mean, so General Butler blows the whistle.
Butler took it to Congressman John McCormick. John McCormick and Morris Dickstein, there was a committee on looking at fascist and Nazi activities in America, and he went to them. He also went to J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, and there were there were some hearings that were held that were executive session. I mean, they were not open to the public. And, of course, everybody denied everything, and it turned out to be pretty much Butler's word against, well, they never even called Clark or Murphy or any of the high-level plotters. They only called Jerry Maguire. He perjured himself on the stand and then died quite suddenly.
And oh, that seems suspicious.
I know. So the whole thing kind of was, it was quickly, it was kind of like the Zangara assassination or execution. It all happened very quickly and didn't really make it into the newspapers except to be ridiculed. You know, Butler was roundly ridiculed, and which was sad because he went, you know, he had been highly decorated. I think one of the only generals to ever receive two Congressional Medals of Honor, and he was, you know, he thought that he had blown the whistle and did the right thing, but he continued throughout his life railing against the these forces in American society. But there's some evidence to suggest that Roosevelt himself, like he did with the assassination attempt, he personally downplayed this. Now, I think that he probably turned his attention toward Wall Street after this. You know, before this, it was like the equivalent of the bailout today. I mean, Roosevelt's New Deal policies were very, he saved American banking. And he was always baffled by this belief that, this feeling that he was a traitor to his class when he felt he had saved capitalism. And, of course, they all welcomed the bailout when it first came. But, you know, months later when it was clear that it wasn't a free handout, that there was going to be regulation, there was a new Securities and Exchange Commission, there was the FDIC. Once that Wall Street realized that, they weren't just getting this money from the government for nothing, then they turned on him.
Yeah. You mention in your book also the strange alliance between these Wall Street plutocrats on the one side. Now, these are some of the wealthiest men in the United States. And these sort of populist demagogues, people like Charles Coughlin and Huey Long. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, basically, these were strange bedfellows organizing in coalition against Roosevelt. And not unlike what happens today as well. I always think of Sarah Palin as Huey Long on estrogen or something. Huey Long was really considered, I think Roosevelt and his advisors considered Huey Long the biggest threat to the presidency. He was thinking about running in 1936, challenging Roosevelt in 1936, and he was really coming from the left, that their wealth was not being distributed enough.
We find that the one crying need of our people, the redistribution of wealth, so that none would be too poor and none would be too rich, is always neglected by the party that is in power.
How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business with.
Huey Long was just about splitting up the grub, wasn't he? In fact, poor old FDR. I mean, he was getting hit from the right. He was getting hit from the left. He's getting hit by the anarchists. Tell us about this guy, Huey Long.
Well, I tell you, he sounds like a door-to-door salesman, doesn't he?
he was a salesman.
In fact,
he was a politician.
That's exactly right. Yeah. He went door-to-door selling anything books to snake oil.
Who was he? Who was Huey Long?
Well, Huey Long, people best know him as the governor of Louisiana. I think he was the 40th governor.
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of great social programs. He built a lot of roads. He started a program for adults to learn how to read. But on the same token, he was also probably one of the slimiest Southern politicians you'd ever hope to learn about, Professor.
Wow. It went beyond slime, though, didn't it? I mean, he assumed virtually dictatorial powers in that state, didn't he?
That's exactly correct. In fact, when they did try to impeach him, he handed out a pledge to 15 senators that said that they would find him not guilty no matter what evidence they found against him.
Wow. And in fact, he came very close to establishing his own sort of security service. There were definitely threats of physical force if people opposed him too strongly.
That's exactly right. He did eventually get assassinated, but the poor man who shot him from about 4 feet away, they found his body riddled with about 60 bullets.
Wow. Jeez Louise. Well, you know, tyrants often come to such ends, but he is often cited, Huey Long is often cited as the closest thing we ever had in this country to an embryonic fascist dictator, because he ruled the state of Louisiana with an iron fist. He got there with his populist rhetoric, and he did it deliver on some of those populist promises, you know, roads and dams and bridges and that sort of thing. But he was a little bit frightening, and I think FDR considered him, of all these people we've talked about during this episode, FDR considered him the biggest threat, didn't he?
Yes, Professor, he was at the very top of that list.
Wow, kind of a fascist guy, was he?
Yes, sir, he definitely was.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, in fact, when he was getting elected, it was a requirement, an unspoken requirement, that the folks who he would be helping had to take a certain percentage of the salaries that they got and put it into his war chest for the next election.
Kickbacks.
Right. But not only just kickbacks. He then, the second he got into office, he fired absolutely everyone who opposed him and put in all of his friends. And like you said before, he completely took over Louisiana politics for that time period.
What kind of man would do this? I mean, who was this guy?
Well, from what we talked about before, he was a vibrant man. He had a tuft of bright red hair and was excellent, excellent speaker. He almost went to school to be a preacher, but he decided that religion wasn't quite for him in that respect. Later became a lawyer after having been a traveling salesperson.
A preacher, a lawyer, a traveling salesman. I see a common thread running through these things. Okay, that's an interesting guy. Okay, tell me more.
Yes, sir. Well, that's what they say about politicians and preachers.
Not separated by very much, huh?
That's exactly...
In some cases. All right, go on.
That's exactly right. He was well known for the way he dressed as well. He started off in white linen suits, and he always spoke real loud and well to everyone who came near him in true Southern fashion. Uh-huh. And then as he started to get involved with FDR, he supported FDR for a while, he started to have a brighter style, very flamboyant. He had bright pink shirts and lime green ties that he would wear to state functions.
Sounds like quite a snappy dresser.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Anything else about Huey Long? We're running out of time, but anything else about Huey before we finish up the show?
He's definitely worth a look at. He's somebody who, if someone was to look him up, he's fun to listen to.
He's fun to listen to. Well, thanks, Drew Taylor, for telling us about those three fascinating people from the 1930s, Huey Long, Father Charles Coughlin, and the Lone Eagle, Charles Lindbergh. Fascinating characters from that decade. I'd also like to thank Sally Denton, who is our author today and who told us about her wonderful new book, The Plots Against the President. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution and you need to learn all about it.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know. Tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world.
Hi, this is Stuart Harris. Before we go, let me just remind you that, hey, we're very high-tech here at Your Weekly Constitutional, so just get online sometime and Google us, Your Weekly Constitutional. You'll pull up our Facebook page. You could be a fan. Well, you'll pull up our Twitter page if you want to. And, of course, you can always get us on iTunes, and you can listen to any of our episodes, all of which are posted as podcasts within a week or so after their first broadcast here at WETS. So get online and get clicking.
Well, you know, we don't love to see the